This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West at the bottom of the hour. That's going to be something to look forward to. And I guess I'm going to try to get through the Bret Baier interview because he came into studio. He's chief political anchor for Fox News, anchor special report. But most importantly, to rescue the American spirit is now out officially today. Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. And the show, Bret, is on Fox Nation now.
It is. Right. 1 hour. It's really good.
Are you dreading this 30 minutes we're going to spend together?
No,
in a way?
I'm in.
You're actually looking forward to it.
100% in.
All right, good. Because I love the book. I had a chance to read. I saw the, what do we call it, the galleys in the business.
Yeah.
I had a chance to, so I knew ahead of time. I like the fact that you took on a Long Island personality who happens to be a president. What is it like being coming to Long Island to do your research?
It's really quite something. You know, because of the fans of Brian Kilmeade.
Right.
They line the streets.
But you got the spies, two blocks, really three blocks, where the spy headquarters was of Robert Townsend and Samuel Townsend. And then a few blocks away, you had Teddy Roosevelt.
Pretty amazing.
And then George Washington stayed in a house one block across the street from where Teddy Roosevelt ultimately was buried. It's that happened in your area.
Chock full of history.
Chock full. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
What you said in this book is you're angry at the people who tried to push him out.
Yes, that's correct.
Some Americans are going to say, seriously?
But not just the party that pushed him out, the party as it's behaving today.
You said you're a member of the inner circle and you never saw the decline. And after that, I wrote, how?
Right. She wrote in her own books and she read her own comments. That's on CBS. Clueless KJP still thinks she can snow America while Democrats get some early rankings on who they like in 2028.
Number two.
I read a poll this morning that said, a lot of Americans are starting to blame Democrats for the government shutdown. And it's just simply because Republicans are better at messaging than Democrats will ever be. I can't believe Democrats still haven't figured out how to message.
Day 21 of the government shutdown with no end in sight. What will it take to end the Schumer-induced deadlock? We're going to bring you the latest from D.C.
Number one.
We're the only two candidates that agree that billionaires shouldn't determine the future of this city are the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee. And that is one place where Curtis and I agree. My advice to him is continue to make his own case.
Right, because in a three-man race, Mondami really stands to benefit. Pressure builds on Curtis Lee to drop out of the New York City mayoral race and allow Cuomo and Mondami to go one-on-one. Will it make a difference? Will Curtis bow out? We're going to examine the panic spread throughout Virginia and New Jersey as two bluish states are having a real run for their money to see who's going to be the chief executive of both those states, respectively. And let's bring in Bret Baier. And Bret, before we get into to rescue the American spirit, let's talk about these two races. If Democrats wanted to send a message in the off-year election, the fact that if this ends up even close, does that blunt that message? Because both were favored, both Democratic candidates were favored to win big.
100%, it blunts the message. And it splits the party. You know, I mean, these are two candidates that I think Democrats thought were well-positioned in Virginia and New Jersey for big wins. And I think Abigail Spanberger is, for moderate Democrats, somebody who, you know, speaks the speak that they want out and about. Mm-hmm. However, she's kind of run into a buzzsaw, and it is tight. And, you know, we talked about it. The Trafalgar poll last week had it at 3 points. If you're at 3 points, that's within the margin of error in a purple state where anything can happen.
So Trump lost by 15 and then by about 6 in the last election in New Jersey. But Jack Cittarelli's been strong against Phil Murphy, loses by 3, a sitting governor. And now he thinks he's a lot closer than 5, which was the last, I think, Quinnipiac poll. Here's Jack Cittarelli yesterday, cut 14.
Not to be disagreeable, but our polls have it much closer. And I think it's the reason why you've seen my opponent get so desperate with her attacks, her blatant lies, one of which is going to land her in court. You know, Shannon, I only have 2021 to compare this to. You remember how close that was? I really thought we were going to win this race, that race. This one is very different. The energy across the state is electric. The reception in minority communities has been great. And I'm being endorsed by prominent Democrats. That tells you all you need to know in terms of the people in New Jersey wanting change. And that's what this election is all about, change.
So he's gonna run through the tape. And Mikey Sherrill has not been a strong candidate.
No, I mean, it feels in both cases, in New Jersey with Mikey Sherrill and in Virginia with Abigail Spanberger, that it's sort of like a prevent defense. You know, they were kind of holding on to leads and then just holding the ball. And as we've seen with basketball teams in the end or football teams, oftentimes that doesn't work if you're still not on the offensive.
How dare you bring up the Giants and the way they lost against Denver.
My God. I wasn't going to go there.
Okay, sorry.
I wasn't going to go there.
I didn't mean to slow you down.
But I do think that it feels like that, and it feels like momentum is on both Republican side. Now, in the New York mayor's race, it's a totally different story.
True. But before we go, I want you to hear this moment. Mikey Sherrill on with Charlemagne the God. She doesn't have answers to questions like, why were you able to walk at your graduation from the academy with this cheating scandal? Her story has changed. What is your agenda? She had no answer when was asked by a local affiliate here in New York City, and then was confronted with her inside stock trade allegations, which got her fined on The Breakfast Club. Listen to this exchange. Cut 15.
Well, did you make $7 million in stock trades at all?
I don't believe I did, but I'd have to go see what that was alluding to.
If you get an opportunity to just clear it up, I think you should take it now. It says she made millions on the stock market, tripling her net worth while in Congress, and was then fined for unreported trades. Is that true or false?
So I think we made money from my husband's job. He gets paid in stocks, they're automatically sold. So I think we made money there.
Good answer.
Holy cow.
Terrible, right?
So bad.
Terrible.
So bad.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is like, if people are looking for a strong candidate, I know you want to vote party if you're a Democrat, but you should vote competence, especially when you talk about chief executive of a state.
Yeah. And more importantly, I think in the debate when Cittarelli says, I'm not going to raise sales tax. And then the question goes to her. And she says, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. And it's like, well, what do you mean?
What do you mean?
What are you saying?
Right. And then she says, I'm going to freeze the price. I'm going to freeze utility. Because you can't freeze things. You can freeze things, but you're just going to pay the price with utilities. But you know what's also happening in real time, Brett? This whole green fever that the world's been running on is broken between the AI and the need for power, which is have people looking to alternative means to the utility costs, and that her choosing, along with New York, not to and Massachusetts, not to be involved in the pipeline that Pennsylvania is in order to fuel their natural gas and energy for their state. They thought we're just going to do it with solar panels, and we're going to do it with different renewables. It hasn't worked out, and now the people's utility bills are doubling, and that's what people are going to vote on.
Yeah, I think so, and you know, that's a major thing for every family if your electric bill is up double.
So today is it's time to rescue the American spirit. What mm-hmm. landed you on this project?
Listen, Teddy Roosevelt, as you well know, is a character. And the anecdotes about his life are just really chock full of detail. He is somebody who is passionate and energetic and jumps off the page. But I wanted to look at his focus on America and leaning forward and the global situation where he really wants to. And his great-grandson, Tweed Roosevelt, said he would want to be remembered for leaning forward and making America a great power throughout the world. And I think, you know, there's a lot of things that he does. He redefines the presidency. As I said on Fox and Friends, 1 through 25 presidents, 1,200 executive orders. He signs 1,300 executive orders. 1,300. President Trump in his first term had 220. Up until now, he has 210. So, I mean, that's a lot of executive action that President Roosevelt
And he's a young guy. So a guy that's known to be robust and physical, used to box in the White House, it started off anything but that. The family had money, but he did not have health. Listen to this. This is a cut from your Fox Nation special, now available on To Rescue the American Spirit. Cut 49.
From the beginning, the survival of Theodore Roosevelt was very much in doubt. His mother did not think that her son would live past 4 or 5 years old.
Through childhood, he watched the outside world from behind a window.
His asthma was so bad that it restricted him to the indoors, so much so that he craved to go outside. He craved to be in nature.
Because of his ailments, he was basically homeschooled throughout his youth, and he had tutors. But even so, he was very bright. He was extremely interested in science in particular.
So he read everything because he couldn't go anywhere, homeschooled, but then he overcompensated perhaps by being this robust adult.
Yeah, and largely because his dad bucked him up and said, you need to be a bigger character. You need to work out. You need to be bold and strong. And he loved the outdoors. He thought he was going to be a scientist. He collected specimens of all kinds. In fact, his family would travel overseas to Europe, and his brother Elliot was his roommate. And he went to his dad and said, Dad, I need my own room. And he said, Elliot, why do you need your own room? And he said, come with me. And he walked down the hall, went into the room, and there were all these dead birds and specimens and entrails in the basin of the tub, because Teddy Roosevelt collected everything. And he was like, he's outdoors
guy. And stuffed them. Right.
Yes. And the father said, okay, Elliot, you get your own room.
So here is Teddy Roosevelt had his ailments. He said that, you know, he looked up to his dad. But the one thing his dad didn't do was fight in the Civil War. And he paid someone to fight for him. And he said that he always said his dad regretted it because his mom says, please don't fight in this war. I have relatives down south. Mm-hmm. I don't want you shooting for other family members. So he did. It was a big regret. And that's why Teddy Roosevelt personally, I think, was always like thirsting to get involved in a conflict, which had him form the Rough Riders and go fight in Cuba.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think that is direct line because his father didn't. And he felt that he needed to. And, you know, when he resigns from Assistant Secretary of the Navy to get involved in the Spanish-American War in Cuba. He has that experience out in North Dakota with the cowboys and the ranchers. He cobbles together this group as well as his friends from Harvard, and it's like this Star Wars bar of fighters that they come together and go to Cuba. He is going over from Florida. He commandeers a boat and realizes that these reporters who were trying to go over there too don't have a boat, so he puts them on his boat. Well, he understands the power of the press, and that's why you get some of these amazing accounts of right. The Rough Riders on San Juan Hill.
And I'll tell you what, two other people in history do. Andrew Jackson, like to fight the press, but know the need for the press. And this other guy named Donald Trump.
100%.
Right? Never stops.
There's a lot of similarities. There's differences, but there's a lot of similarities in the bold actions, the expansion of executive power, but also the knowledge of the press, both fighting them and using them and sucking up all the oxygen in the room.
So Brett's book is out today. So don't blame yourself if you don't have it yet. Now it's time to order it. To Rescue the American Spirit, Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. We're on the eve of America's 250th birthday. These are the characters that stand out for a reason. And by the way, he did it all not living to 60. So, man, unbelievable what he accomplished. More with Brett Baer in just a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. It gives me great pleasure to tell you that Simply Safe is now available at 50% off because you're listening to this podcast. So go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Now, why is Simply Safe so perfect? Number one, it's easily put in. Number two, it's unbelievably effective. Number three, they're using AI now to stop the break-in, not just catch the people that are doing it, but to stop them before they infiltrate your life and destroy your personal property. I personally trust these people. This is a game changer. The agents take action while the intruder is still on the outside. They confront the intruder, letting them know they're being watched on camera, and you know they're going to head for the hills because they're going to head right to prison if they don't, and hopefully they still will. There are no long-term contracts. There are no hidden fees. Get this. The U.S. News & World Report, they named them SimpliSafe the best home security system. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what price can you put on safety? Well, SimpliSafe is easy to install. They're always improving the product, and it's affordable. Why can't you be safe? The answer is, of course you can. Go get SimpliSafe. Save your 50% by going to SimpliSafe.com/Brian. Get it.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we are back. Brett Baer is in studio. Well, Brett's always loyal to the show, but especially when his book's out, To Rescue the American Spirit, Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. So, Brett, the one thing that people, I don't think, really understood, I think that to a degree, I think Teddy Roosevelt wanted American to be proud of their country. And he had a real sense of history. And I think he wanted it to display when he ascended to the chief executive. But as you write in your book, it's a fluke that he's president.
Yeah,
because they were not happy. He was such a disruptor as governor of New York, coming off being a war hero in Cuba in the Spanish War. They put him there, and they couldn't control him.
Yeah.
So it's a fluke that he becomes vice president, which is where careers go to die.
Well, that's why they put him there, is because the establishment Republican Party says, let's stick him here and he can't cause any trouble because he's a troublemaker. You're right. He gets back from the war in Cuba, he's a big hero. And that's in May. The election's in November, and they put him up for New York governor. He becomes New York governor. But because he's such a troublemaker as far as all the things he's trying to do, antitrust, pushing back, representing workers, he felt a real compassion for laborers. The party says, listen, we don't want him to continue to do this. And they put him as vice president. 6 months later, McKinley is shot in Buffalo at the exposition. Roosevelt goes there. The doctors say they think McKinley's going to be okay. Go back on your vacation. He goes to the Adirondacks in the middle of nowhere, and they have to send out a prospector to find him up in the mountains to tell him that McKinley's turning south. And that's a treacherous ride all the way down to the train station to Buffalo, where he gets there and McKinley's dead.
Why do you think he felt he could do the job?
You know,
when he becomes president.
I think, well, first of all, when he takes over, he tells the cabinet that he's going to keep them. He tells everyone he's going to keep McKinley's policies. He's going to continue to operate like McKinley would want to. And that lasts for a little while, but not long.
Right.
And he becomes his own man. I think he had a lot of thoughts about how America should be aggressive, the conservation element. Think about all the things around the country that have been saved and put aside because of Roosevelt.
Yeah, he formed the national park system, one of the many things he's done. But with his contradictory, like the Republicans have this sense of a party of big business. And he's from money. The Roosevelts have money. But yet he looked at big business as a hindrance to the country's growth, a failure to spread out the wealth. That's not a typical Republican axiom.
Right. I mean, he said he was for capitalism, but capitalism had to be for everyone. And so that's how his prison that he looked through. So he fought for laborers. He got involved in a coal mining dispute when the coal miners were on strike. He's the first president to get in the middle of a labor dispute. He files 40 antitrust lawsuits as president. J.P. Morgan is livid with him as he's kind of battling. He says, J.P. Morgan says, why don't you have your guy talk to my guy and we can work this out behind closed doors? And Roosevelt says, that's exactly what I don't want to do, is scratching the back behind closed doors. I want the laborer to be front and center.
So I don't know if you feel the same way, but the word is, before he took that trip and got really sick and ultimately died to Amazon, There was talk about him queuing up again and running for president.
In 20. He was the leading front runner. And
even though he had lost as a split off from the Republican Party, and Woodrow Wilson won two terms.
And they blame basically Roosevelt for Woodrow Wilson winning, and they obviously can, because the Bull Moose Party, the Progressive Party, gets the most votes of any independent, more than Ross Perot did against Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. But right. He is in position. He's the leading candidate. And what really kills him is not that trip, but the death of his son, Quentin, who dies in World War One as a fighter pilot. And he's dealt with despair his whole life. His mother and his wife die on the same day, on Valentine's Day. But it's his son dying that really takes his steam out.
Right. And he says one of his big regrets was not saying after he won his election, I'm not going to run for a second term. He said it was a big regret. He almost regretted it from the moment he said it, because then he didn't want to go back on his word.
The man in the arena speech is really talking about him. He wants to get back in the arena.
Right, always. Brett, you're always in the arena. Pick up the book, To Rescue the American Spirit. Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
He talked way less to the press than Donald Trump does. Way less. And he wasn't out there at all. He wasn't good off the cuff. He wasn't doing press conferences. Let's just be real. Like, he didn't do big events.
Tim, that's not true. Tim, you're conflating all of it. That's what you're doing. No, you're telling me he didn't talk well about it. Then you're telling me he didn't talk at all.
He didn't do either. He didn't talk very often. And when he did, it wasn't very good. Yeah, he sounded very
maybe
old.
Maybe you weren't paying attention to what we were doing at the White House.
Unbelievable. KJP is still trying to pretend as if she could snow the American public and respect the position that she had because she was speaking for the president. Now she's speaking for herself and expects us to buy her flat out lies. Tim Miller, a podcaster who you've seen him all around. He is not a conservative. He was just asking her, just be honest. He wasn't there. Yeah, he got older and he wasn't doing the job. He worked 4 hours a day. We already know it. Two books have been written about it in the last 3 months. She wants to write a book and say, I left the Democratic Party because they left the Biden family. It's unbelievable, the audacity. For Jake Tapper to come out and say, I can't believe it. Joe Biden wasn't making any decisions at the end. Really? What have you been watching? And then I thought that was something to believe and behold. And now KJP beats us all, beats them all, everybody, in what she wants us to believe with her new book, Cut 24.
When we talk about the mental acuity, and again, I take this very, very seriously. Yeah. I never saw anyone who wasn't there. I saw someone who was always engaged. I saw someone who understood policy, pushed us on the policy, and also understood history. And there were times, I'll tell you the story, there were times where he would call me into the Oval Office, and I would be like, oh, no, because I knew whatever he was going to ask me was going to be direct, was going to be about a story he read, about how we're pushing back, how we're pushing a message forward.
I don't know what she's talking about. And we already know when the James Comer investigation into the auto pen, that most of his aides didn't even meet with him. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins us now. Dallas County Republican Chair, American Constitutional Rights Executive Director, former Congressman of Florida. Colonel, do you believe that she wants us to believe that Joe Biden was on top of things and was as active as Trump? I mean, are you kidding? Are you kidding?
Well, look, this is the delusion that is out there. And you just brought up Jake Tapper and now Karine Jean-Pierre. These people believe that they can go out and they can write books and act as if, I had no knowledge or I didn't understand. I'm just surprised so they can get paid millions of dollars for these things. But the American people know the truth. It is out there, many accounts thereof. And it would just be a semblance of courage to just stand up and say he was not on his A game. And again, how can she sit up and say that, you know, he will call me into his office? We know he didn't have a cabinet meeting for what, almost a year, more than a year?
Yep.
So these
four,
are the
I think he had six in 4 years.
Six cabinet meetings in 4 years. Donald Trump has already had six cabinet meetings in his first 6 months. And so the comparison, there is no comparison. But this is why the Democrat Party today, really the Democrat Socialist Party, they're losing communications battle. They're losing the message battle. They're losing their credibility all around.
I mean, and now she's mad at the Democratic Party, who basically knows that they covered up for Joe Biden. And she's saying, nothing to cover up here. Listen to this. Cut 26.
What you said in this book is you're angry at the people who tried to push him out.
Yes, that's correct.
Some Americans are going to say, seriously?
But not just the party that pushed him out, the party as it's behaving today in this moment when we need a Democratic Party to be fighting, to be an opposition party. So it's connected also to the moment that we are in. I'm telling a story, obviously, my story, and how I started thinking about the Democratic Party and my involvement in it. And then fast forward to today, the disappointment, the disillusionment that millions of people have.
She says the Democratic Party is disappointing her by not fighting more. I mean, didn't they impress her by ignoring their feeble boss?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously she did not see the quote-unquote Democrat Party in the streets this past weekend. I don't know if that's fighting. It is definitely more disillusionment. It's disillusionment for them to not understand that the American people rejected their policy ideas, rejected those ideas, rejected the Biden-Harris administration and even the continuation of the Obama policies. But for whatever reason, she did not see the same debate performance of Joe Biden against Donald Trump that we saw. And that caused all the trepidation for the Democrats to say, we can't go on this way. This guy is not there. And so that's why they sought to go over to someone else. I think she's just upset because she's out of a job. And now she's trying to go out there and peddle her wares, as they say.
She got a job. Remember, that just to get her to step aside, she was so hideous at her job. They gave her a job on Angie's List or something as an executive. And she refused to take it. And remember, with Admiral Kirby clearly better at his job than she was, at her job than he was, she would not leave. She would call on the press people for Kirby because they were in the middle of two wars and she has no idea about anything militarily. Now, Admiral Kirby, you know, I've known him before. I don't know if it's the nature of the job, but the way he was dishonest and I think disingenuous with the military conflict from Afghanistan on down, I had a problem with. But he knew his stuff. And then he had to figure out how he was going to say it. But she never knew her stuff. And that she was jealous of him shows how shallow she was.
Well, she's incredibly shallow. I think it's your colleague, Waters, Waters World, he referred to her as the binder. I mean, I have not seen Carolyn Leavitt come to the podium with a big, thick binder that she has to refer to. I mean, she's able to articulate herself extemporaneously. Karine Jean-Pierre was not able to do that. And so many times, like you said, she had that deer in the headlights look. And I agree with you with Admiral Kirby. I mean, you know, some of the spin that he put on a lot of the policies, especially foreign policies, national security policies of the Biden administration, just made you scratch your head. But at least he was articulate in his spinning. Karine Jean-Pierre was not anywhere, shape, form, or fashion able to, command the respect and the credibility of that position as White House spokesperson.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Jen Psaki, you might not agree with her, but she was very good at her job, right?
Yeah, I'll get back to you on that.
Right, circle back. Let's talk about this mayor's race in New York City. Do you think it's a national story?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it absolutely is a national story because, you know, let's just look at this. It was September 11, 2001. We know what happened in New York City. Now they're about to elect a Hamas, an Islamic jihadist supporter, to be the mayor of that city. And you're talking about the financial capital of the United States of America, if not the world, in New York City, and you're electing someone, a Marxist, who believes in Karl Marx's principle of from each according to their ability to each according to their need, wealth redistribution. He wants to defy our Constitution and provide sanctuary to people that are here illegally. And crossing the border into the United States of America is a federal offense, Title 18, United States Code 1325. So that's the type of person that New York may have as a mayor.
So here is John Catsimatidis, self-made billionaire who has been friends with Curtis forever and employs him as a talk show host and backed him, but now says this, cut seven.
Cuomo's not getting out. But like I said, the real Democrat in the function is Cuomo, and it's not Mondami. Mondami is a socialist, and people should realize that they're not voting for a Democrat. Just because he won the Democratic primary doesn't mean he's a Democrat. You know, socialism hit Venezuela. Me and Curtis were in Cuba. The people in Cuba are starving to death. The people in Venezuela are starving to death. The Mondami is not the way to go for a city like New York City. Curtis, look, he's a Republican, and that's fine. But if Curtis loves New York, that if he doesn't see a path to winning by the next week or so, if he doesn't see a path to winning, then at that point you say, I love New York more than I love running and give it up.
And now the Republican Party in New York says Curtis Bennett should not quit. They have his full backing. What would you like to see happen?
I would like to see what's best for New York City. Without a doubt. And I think that if you go along the path that you have right now with three different candidates, that means that the one candidate who won the quote-unquote Democrat primary by ranked choice voting, I'm sure that you are well aware of the nefarious aspects of that system of voting. It disenfranchises people. New York is heading down. And look, Brian, I went to East Berlin back in 1985 as a young lieutenant when it was still a separated city. I saw what the other side looks like. I saw what Zoran Mamdani believes in and what he'd like to see happen in New York City. That's disgusting. It's despicable. And I can't believe that we're sitting around and having that discussion in a city not too long ago, you know, 250 years ago, American men were losing their lives in the battle for independence against King George III.
That's what we're dealing with right now. So I guess we're going to have to see what's going on. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, thanks so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure. You take care, Brian.
All right, got it. When we come back, we're going to talk about what the latest is in Ukraine, the president's stance as he tries to set up a meeting in Budapest, what I think he's got to do before he goes. Also on Gaza, we know the vice president has landed over in Tel Aviv in Israel to get an update on what's happening with the very tenuous ceasefire between a very distrustful Hamas. And whatever you think about Israel, and I'm giving them high marks throughout this entire conflict, they are abiding by the ceasefire demands, even though two of their soldiers were killed just for standing on the yellow line, which they were supposed to be doing. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete, not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You got to pick a lane if you're trying to sell a Biden book, and this is no lane that anyone wants to travel on at this point. I was actually surprised because she leaked out, you know, a few months ago that she's an independent now. So it seemed like it was going to be a burn it all down book. But she wants to burn the party down while still holding him up. And I think there is an elegant way that you could seem like you weren't totally stabbing your boss in the back without seeming like you are completely detached from reality. And I do not know who will be making the purchase, but maybe you guys told me it's all about the advance.
Yes, it is.
It was the advance.
So I guess she's not going to earn out, in other words. So Jessica Tarlov weighing in, who often plays the Democrat every day on The Five, she came in and said, I don't get it. That's just it. It doesn't even matter who you voted for. I don't get it. So she's trying to win over the Bidens. The Bidens aren't even together on the Bidens. So we all know that it was a catastrophe. We all know the pardons and the auto pen. And I'm not for what the president did framing the auto pen because they're going to, who knows what they're going to do to his picture when a Democrat wins. But because he could put all those pictures out in the West Wing. So we'll see how that goes. But I just don't get it. You know, when Jake Tapper writes the book, pretending it has all these revelations and these true stories, I think they're all true. But how he could say that he had no idea that Joe Biden was detached, not on things, when he put the lid on in 4 hours, when he couldn't have a speech, when he had to do interviews, they barely were audible. And then we saw what happened in the debate. People keep pointing to the debate. The debate was the last. Most people were not surprised that he was going to be that terrible at the debate. Here's Christina Pescucci. She's a political strategist. And she doesn't understand her approach either. Cut 29.
I want to take you back to June 15th, 2024. It was a fateful day for Democrats. And I remember because I was there in the Peacock Theater in Los Angeles, where President Biden took the stage alongside President Barack Obama. And there were thousands of Democrats in the room that day. The very passionate Democrat I was sitting next to looked at me a few minutes in to President Biden speaking and said, oh, expletive, we're expletives. And
right.
Yeah, everyone could see what was happening. And that was before the disastrous debate. So for her to come out now with this book and say this, it's one of a couple things. If she is, in fact, speaking the truth, either she had no access to the president or she doesn't have emotional awareness, and either would be very scary. I think if we just said and acknowledged what the situation was with President Biden, we'd stop talking about it and focus on things that actually matter.
And what she's talking about is the George Clooney fundraiser when the president had to be helped off the stage by former President Barack Obama. And they said, well, Obama made him look bad by grabbing him by the shoulder. What choice did he have? Leave him up there by himself? He wasn't moving. Lastly, when we talk about what's happening today with the shutdown, why do we have the shutdown? Well, it looked as though Senator Schumer said, I am not going to sign off on a continuing resolution to negotiate these appropriations bills because I don't like the cuts, the paring back of the eligibility with Obamacare, which they opened it up. They have 400% of the poverty line. I don't like the fact that the tax breaks that were put together during the pandemic and the subsidies that were offered during the pandemic by Joe Biden, they're no longer going to be in place. We're going to get back to having people have a work requirement when it comes to the free health care. And we're going to make sure the people that are eligible are actually getting it. And the ones that aren't eligible aren't, from what the whole thing was intended to. Bottom line, if Obamacare worked, it would not need these additional subsidies, but it has not worked out. The math does not add up. It brings me to this exchange on The Breakfast Club with Charlemagne the God. He says right now the messaging should be for Democrats just about health care. I have a problem with that messaging because it is really about a continuing resolution to negotiate the budget for the next year. And these are the Biden budget lines right now. This is Joe Biden's budget. Remember, Donald Trump doesn't come in and pass a budget. This is his first year for a budget. So listen to this exchange with Charlemagne the God on an MSNBC anchor's MSNBC anchor, cut 22.
I read a poll this morning that said, a lot of Americans are starting to blame Democrats for the government shutdown. And it's just simply because Republicans are better at messaging than Democrats will ever be. I can't believe Democrats still haven't figured out how to message. But right now, at a time when American people are hurting and they can point directly to the Trump administration and say, earlier in the year, it was DOGE cutting all the federal jobs. Now they are in charge of every branch of government, and it's a government shutdown, and all of y'all are losing jobs. The fact that they can't message that it's the Republicans that are hurting their pockets right now, and people still think it's the Democrats, it's insane.
Well, I mean, that's his opinion, and they could keep leaning on it. But a couple of things are going to happen. We know that healthcare premiums are going to go up. That's Obamacare. And I think the Republicans message that and say, look, you guys went out of your way to do everything possible to make sure Obamacare lived. And it had to be subsidized heavily. And now Joe Biden had to go back and put more money into it. And now you're upset the Republicans aren't pouring money into that money pit. So don't expect that. And that's one thing you could be saying. Obamacare has not worked. We've been sold, whatever you thought, it was sincere or not. It has not worked out. If you want to continue to have it, you got to find a different way to pay for it, because everybody's premiums are going up because of the tax breaks are not available. They were all conditioned and offered to sunset when the pandemic was over. Now it's time for them to sunset. So it comes off and they say Republicans are cutting health care. No. If you want to address health care, I think there's something worthy of going over it. For example, when it comes to these rural hospitals, these hospitals are going out of business anyway. These rural hospitals are getting $50 billion in the big, beautiful bill just for rural hospitals. But right now, everything is closed. Chip Roy came out and said Republicans should just blow up the filibuster, pass on a simple 50-plus vote, and then fund the government. But I think the precedent is bad on that. I don't think you want to get rid of the filibuster. Then people are going to pack the court. They're going to add two states, pass whatever agenda, and severely bring the country in a different direction. If when Democrats win, and then they'll bring them the other way if Republicans win, I would hold out on that. Unlike Democrats who wanted to pass that, except for Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, high around the country, around the world. The shutdown continues. Now we're up to day 21. Speaker Johnson speaking on Capitol Hill, outlining his plan. I'm keeping everybody out until there's a chance a vote will pass. We did what we're supposed to do. It's up to the Senate to do what they're supposed to do. So he stays out. The Senate stays in. But no one works and no one's getting paid, really. The next paycheck for the Defense Department will not have any money in it. Neither will all federal workers, TSA, any air traffic controllers. It's getting bad. And we'll take your calls on that. But before we get to Jamie Metzl, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
What you said in this book is you're angry at the people who tried to push him out.
Yes, that's correct.
Some Americans are going to say, seriously?
But not just the party that pushed him out, the party as it's behaving today.
You said you're a member of the inner circle and you never saw the decline. And after that, I wrote, how?
Clueless KJP still thinks she can snow the American people while Dems get some early rankings on who they like for 2028.
Number two.
I read a poll this morning that said, a lot of Americans are starting to blame Democrats for the government shutdown. And it's just simply because Republicans are better at messaging than Democrats will ever be. I can't believe Democrats still haven't figured out how to message.
Really? Okay, day 21 of the government shutdown. That was Charlemagne the God. What will it take to end the Schumer-induced deadlock? We're going to bring you the latest. He says the longer it goes, the more they're winning.
Number one.
We're the only two candidates that agree that billionaires shouldn't determine the future of this city are the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee. And that is one place where Curtis and I agree. My advice to him is continue to make his own case.
Yes, Mondavi wants Curtis to stay in the race because in a three-man race, he wins by 20. In a one-on-one, according to one poll, Cuomo and Mondavi, it's 2 to 3 points. Will Curtis bow out? The New York Post wants him to. John Catsimatidis wants him to. But the New York City Republican Party does not want him to. We'll also bring up to date on what's happening in Virginia and New Jersey. And let's bring in Jamie Metzl, former NSC and State Department staffer under Bill Clinton, Senate Foreign Relations staffer under Joe Biden, former UN official and author of Now Out on Paperback Today, Super Convergence. Jamie, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. Always happy to be here.
First off, you see the pressure on Curtis Lee would drop out. What do you think he should do?
I think he should drop out. Mamdani is a disaster. I am a Democrat. I'm a liberal Democrat. As you know, I work for Bill Clinton and others. Mamdani is the worst. To have somebody in New York City who is convorting with World Trade Center terrorists, who wants to globalize the Intifada to control the means of production, Mamdani is a fundamental threat to the city of New York. We should all be rallying to defeat this. I really think he's dangerous to the fabric of the city. And Sliwa cannot win, obviously. So if whatever he's looking for, attention, a platform, let's give him those things. But this city deserves a one-on-one race between Cuomo and Mamdani.
Do you like Cuomo?
You know, I like him well enough. I mean, politics is about the available options. And Cuomo, obviously, he has flaws and shortcomings, but he definitely knows politics. He definitely knows how to get things done. He definitely has relevant experience. So I just think that between these two candidates, Cuomo is so many orders of magnitude better than Mamdani, whose entire career has been based around anti-Israel and anti-Semitism. He really has no relevant experience almost. He's really achieved nothing. Cuomo knows how the system works, and I think this city will be much, much, much better off with him in the lead.
Here he is going after Cuomo. Mamdani, cut one.
We have a little over 2 weeks left until the general election. And Andrew Cuomo is spending more time pleading with another candidate to drop out than making his case to New Yorkers as to why he would be the next mayor. If you want to transform the most expensive city in the United States into one that's affordable, one that's sensible, one that is safe, then we are the campaign for you. And that's why we are spending this time speaking directly to New Yorkers. Andrew Cuomo spending it speaking about the other candidates on the ballot.
So, your thoughts, 34 years old now.
You know, when there is a third party candidate, it generally harms one of the candidates. And so we saw with Ross Perot and George H.W. Bush, that's just the nature of our political system. So it makes sense for everybody who thinks that Mamdani poses a fundamental threat to this city, which is what I believe.
Why does New York City not see that? Why do you know he won the primary and now he's winning by 10, 15 points? Why don't they not see that?
You know, I think that there are just these trends in society, and I just think that our young people have just been taken over by this madness. Certainly, this Free Palestine movement, I see it as almost a form of collective madness, where so many people are basically allying themselves with Hamas, this terrible terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. All of us, our hearts should go out to the people of Palestine, but supporting Hamas and wanting to globalize the Intifada is the worst thing for the Palestinian people. And we're seeing it now that the Hamas is doing public executions in Gaza.
Right. Shooting in the back of the head by people they say are collaborating with Israel, that the Israel identified clans that they felt they could work with. My sense is those were part of that. So they immediately got their guns and shot them. In the next phase, they're not supposed to have guns. Jamie, what are the chances of them giving up their guns?
Zero, based on their intention. I mean, Hamas is an armed terrorist resistance organization with the sole articulated goal of wiping out Israel. So they're not going to give up their guns on their own. And for those people who are calling the people of Gaza indigenous, whether they are or they aren't is certainly a matter of debate. And certainly the Jews are more indigenous to that region. But if you believe in that indigeneity argument, these tribes, the Bedouins, are actually the indigenous communities of that space. Most of these other people are people who came later, including in the 1940s. And so those are the people who are getting executed now. So if you are somebody who is for indigenous rights, every single person who was out in the Free Palestine protests, they should be out on the streets now.
Where are they?
They're invisible because this was never ultimately about them, or these people were just so ignorant that they learned some stuff on TikTok and thought they had the whole story.
Right. So I know that I'm glad to see I'm glad to see that the vice president's going to be there and Steve Witkoff's going to be there, because it's going to take constant vigilance. Also, you have to assemble that peacekeeping force. And it's got to be Egypt and Jordan are training, but we need 30,000 troops in there. But they got to be afraid. They got to be troops that Hamas is afraid to kill.
Yeah. And so that's the issue is a lot of these troops from Islamic states are going to have a very hard time going in and fighting against Hamas the way that the IDF has done. And I think they probably won't even go in if that is what they're going to be asked to do. So that's why this is such a tricky moment, because there's just a little window when the future, the direction of the future is being determined. And if this is a future where Hamas is given the green light to kill and reassert control and maintain all of their weapons, it's going to be harder and harder for an international force to go in.
Right. And you got to blow up the tunnels.
Yes.
Yeah. You got to destroy everything, and you got to rebuild it as if an earthquake, a tsunami, and a hurricane hit.
Yep.
And it's hard enough to do, but if people are shooting at you, you're not going to be able to get heavy equipment in there.
Yeah, yeah, and so that's why it looks like what if there isn't some kind of stability within the 47% of Gaza that's currently controlled, it seems, by Hamas, then there's going to be an East Berlin, West Berlin situation where in the 53% of the territory that is currently under the control of the IDF, that's where the rebuilding is going to happen. They're going to be vetted Palestinians able to move into this area where there is reconstruction, where there is security. And I frankly think that most of the people in Gaza will not want to live in the Escape from New York territory, and they're going to want to live in this more secure area. And ironically, all of these globalized, the Intifada people are going to have to come to the realization that it will be safer for the people of Gaza to be in territory along with the IDF than to be in territory that's controlled by Hamas.
It'd be very interesting to see, because we cannot bring the aid in at great lengths unless we get the bodies back. That's the deal.
Yeah.
And in fact, I talked to someone on Thursday night and they said, we told Hamas where to locate 10 bodies, specifically where to hold. So you could say, I need heavy equipment. Well, I'll tell you where 10 are.
Yep.
They returned two. And no, they returned three, but one was wrong.
It's the same games that they're doing. They have no intention of living. They will only do what they are absolutely forced to do. And so they see these dead bodies as chips to be traded. So they're only going to do what they are pressured to do.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a time out and come back. And Super Convergence, the book that you loved on hardcover, is now out on paperback. We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back. Also, I want to talk about what's happening in Ukraine as the president gets set to go over to Hungary to meet with Vladimir Putin. My hope is that Zelensky will be in one room and Putin will be in the other room. We'll see if that happens.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade.
We all love a legendary comeback, and Degree Original Cool Rush is back and better than ever. Cool Rush isn't just a scent, it's a movement, a fan favorite that delivers bold, fresh vibes and all-day sweat protection. Whether you have a man that spends hours in the gym, heads into the office early, or is just trying to stay fresh on a long day, Cool Rush has their back. Head to your local Walmart or Target and grab Degree Cool Rush, the fan favorite scent from the world's number one antiperspirant brand.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. Jamie Metzl here, longtime Democrat, was worked for Biden as well as Obama. His book is now on paperback, Super Convergence, How Genetics, Biotech, and the AI Revolution Will Transform Our Lives, Work, and the World. And Jamie, we're already seeing it, right?
Everywhere.
Could you describe the pace you thought AI would be at and describe the pace it's at?
So I thought it would be incredibly fast. For years, I've been talking about exponential change, which just means it's on a J curve, because every time you have an innovation, it spurs future innovations. If you have AI that helps us write computer code faster, then computer code is part of so many other things. And if we're doing that faster, we have more innovations. So I always thought it would be incredibly fast, but this is even faster. And when people think of the AI revolution, they think of ChatGPT. But it's much bigger story than that. That's what the book is actually about. Like, if I ask you, how did electricity influence your life today, you can't even answer the question. Electricity is part of everything. And if you say, where do you go to do electricity? You don't say, I go to the power station to do electricity. You say electricity is part of everything that we're doing. This broadcast, our haircuts, our clothes, really everything. And so it isn't just, GPT-5 is cooler than GPT-4. It's how is this technology weaving into everything else? It's weaving into healthcare. You and I have talked about this in the past, how we intervene with my father's cancer, my unfortunately late father's cancer care, and we got him 2 extra years of life using these technologies. So we're seeing transformations in healthcare, agriculture. We're going towards 10 billion humans. We need to have greater productivity in agriculture. And these tools of intersecting AI, genetics, and biotechnology revolutions are going to help us grow more food with fewer inputs of land and water and fertilizer, computing. Right now, the reason we have to build so many of these data centers is because we're just storing these massive and growing amounts of data. But DNA is a million times denser than silicon. Unlike silicon, which on these magnetic tapes can last for 30 to 50 years, DNA under the right conditions can store data reliably for 2 to 5 million years.
Wow.
So we're on the cusp of these revolutions really across the board, and it's really exciting. There are risks. You and I have talked for a long time about COVID origins. I've been involved with the issue of the CRISPR babies born in China. So there are real downsides, risks, but that's the same with every technology. And now is the time for everybody. And that's the reason I've written this book in a really accessible way so people can read it in bed or on the beach to say, hey, this is a really important story. It's relevant to me, and here are the things that I can do to learn more, to engage, and to be part of the conversation about where we go from here.
You can't avoid it. Just like you can't avoid it. It's like the horse to the car.
Yeah.
You can't say, well, I'm going to stay on the horse. That's not going to work in this world.
And that's why learning about it is really – people don't need to be scared of this technology, but they all need to say, well, how do I want to integrate it into my life in a really helpful way? I was in Italy a month ago. It was the Italian version of this book came out, and I was giving a talk, and I could tell that not everybody in the audience was understanding me. And then this old lady came up to me and said in Italian, which I don't speak, but there was someone who translated, oh, I loved your talk. And she didn't speak a word of English. And I said, well, how did you love my talk if you don't speak a word of English? And then she said in Italian, this little lady, she had her phone, and she said, I asked ChatGPT to translate your talk while you were speaking.
Wow.
There's just a lot of really wonderful things. I know people are scared, but just go as a start, just go to ChatGPT and just play around, have fun. We should hallucinate in our side of things.
No, I understand. And when you talk about winning the race against China, we've had different people here, Tristan Harris, for example,
sure.
And say,
yeah.
Really? Well, we beat everyone on the iPhone. How did that work out for us? We beat everyone on social media.
Yeah.
How'd that work out for us? We have to do it responsibly.
Yep.
Okay. We do it responsibly. Let's do it in a way that's not going to end the world that Elon Musk warned us about. All right, fine. But you know who probably doesn't care about that?
Yeah. China. And that's why it's a balance. I mean, we need to do this carefully. Like if you have a fast car and all you do is ride around town with your foot 100% on the gas, it's not that this is great, I'm going fast. You're going to crash the car. And so even if you want to go as fast as possible, you have to find the right balance between the gas and the brakes. And, and that's why the people who are saying we just need, no holes barred, everything forward, I think that's the wrong answer. And the people who are saying, oh, AI is going to kill us all, we need complete regulation and slow everything down, or even the people who are calling for a moratorium, I don't think that's the right answer either. But that's why we need to really say, well, what's the right way? What's the right speed? What's the right process to get us where we need to go?
The name of the book is Superconvergence, out on paperback today. I want to talk about right now. I know how early it is. We're not even at the midterms yet. But they did a poll, and they said, you know, who's right now the front runner for 2028? Kamala Harris is the front runner. She's got 33% of the vote, 27% of the of independents. So Harris is number one. I was surprised by that. Newsom's number 20 is number two at 21. Not Sure is 17. Oh. AOC is 8. Mayor Pete is 7. Shapiro 4. Pritzker 4. Whitmer 3. Westmore 1. So preliminary. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it would be an absolute disaster for the Democrats to go back to Harris. Joe Biden, you mentioned, is my former boss. I just think he betrayed this entire country by seeking re-election. And then because we had no competitive primary, Kamala Harris was basically forced on the country, and it wasn't a reasonable choice. We needed a primary. The reason she's leading now is everybody knows her because she was the person who ran last time. I hope that we have a highly competitive primary and then let the most talented people win. Wes Moore is an old friend of mine. I absolutely love the guy. I think he's a great candidate. Josh Shapiro is a great candidate. Gretchen Whitmer is a great candidate. The Democrats have a lot of depth. We have a lot
You didn't mention Newsom.
You know, Newsom is great, but I just feel like we need to turn over a new page as the Democratic Party. I think the people are kind of sick of
the policies.
Sick of the faces. People are just kind of sick of us. And the Democrats, I hate to say it because I am a Democrat. I'm a centrist liberal Democrat. We really just screwed it up. We screwed it up with Biden. We screwed it up with immigration. We screwed it up with letting big cities kind of go down the tubes.
And that's what Fareed Zakaria said.
Yeah. And so we need to own that. And I think putting another one of these same old faces out for it is the wrong message. We have these wonderful young people, Josh Beer, Wes Moore, Gretchen Whitmer. We have superstars. And I think had we had a competitive primary last time, we would have had a much better chance of winning. We need to do that this time.
What if Bernie wins? And that would say Bernie's too old. What if AOC wins? You'd be back in the Mamdani lane.
I totally agree. And that's why I'm so against Mamdani. I think this is the absolute wrong face of the Democratic Party.
George Mamdani, Will wants him to win.
If Mamdani is the face of the Democratic Party, we are a permanent minority party. I believe this country is stronger with two robust parties who are putting ideas forward.
Center left, center right. That's what you like to see.
I'm centrist. I think most Americans are centrists. And I think that we need to find a way of coming together, including centrist Democrats and centrist Republicans, caucusing together. I'd love to see.
And maybe in the lockout.
Yeah. No, most Americans want sensible governance.
Pick up Super Convergence, out on paperback. Jamie Metzl, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Excuse me, sir. I'm so sorry, man. I'm like two quarters short. Do you have anything?
I have one?
Yeah. Man, that'll work. All right. Hey, a quarter's good, better than nothing. What's your name, man?
Cedric.
Great to meet you. I'm Jimmy. Thank you. Can you hold this for a second?
Sure.
I got $500 for you.
What?
I didn't need your help.
Seriously?
Yes. Is it going to help out?
Oh, absolutely. My tire's fixed to my car. Is this real?
It is, man. Bless you.
No, it's to the point where I can only get certain things done one at a time. I just got my brakes done.
Yeah, well, why were you helping me out when you're, like, barely staying afloat yourself?
Truthfully, you know what, to be honest with you, I just started coming around to the point in my life where I'm starting to see people as brothers and sisters. Man, can I hug you one more time? Thanks.
So that is just a slice of Jimmy Dart's life. He's the author of a brand new book called Undercover Kindness, saying yes to love, no to fear, and embracing the life-changing power of ordinary generosity. Jimmy, welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And the book's out today, right?
Yep, just came out, and hopefully, it encourages people that, ordinary generosity is powerful. I think so often we celebrate someone writing $1 million check or this nonprofit, which those things are great, but it's really the small acts that never get noticed that really is what this country is made of.
So tell me the premise, where you came up with this idea and what you're actually doing. You're putting people to the test.
Yeah. So about 5 years ago, I started following Jesus when I was 18 years old, but the Lord put on my heart, he goes, Jimmy, I want you to make videos where you ask strangers for help. And when they help you change their life. I was like, that's a pretty wild concept. I've never heard of that. And so I began just asking people for a dollar at the gas station or for
food. So pretending like you're homeless?
Yeah, just all types of things.
Would you dress the part?
Yeah, I would dress the part. I have different outfits and stuff I put on and basically just go everywhere from alleyways to Walmarts to laundromats. And that first kind stranger that helps me out, we then reward their kindness with $500. And the crazy thing is it doesn't stop there. It just begins. And millions of people online see these acts of kindness and go, you know what? I want to help this lady, this guy more. And so, just last week we raised over $400,000 for a couple living in their car.
You say it was a pastor?
Yeah.
So tell me that.
Yeah. So there's a pastor, 1-year-old daughter they had. They were living in their car, just lost his full-time job. And I came up on them and he immediately goes, I know who you are. And I was like, dang it. I can't do a kindness test on this guy. He knows who I am. And then I was like, actually, the fact that he was honest and wasn't trying to pretend like he didn't know me, I think he just passed the test and it was the honesty test. And so I gave him $1,000 for his honesty. Him and his wife were just bawling their eyes out. And sure enough, I upload this video on YouTube, TikTok, and we raised over $400,000 for them, and they're off the streets now. So,
and so your goal would be to see if people would help other people, and then in turn, they pass the honesty test, and then you reward them, and then you post that, and then you give people the opportunity to support that person.
Absolutely, because these people that have helped me out in these videos, they've been living a lifestyle of kindness and have never been noticed for it, never been rewarded for it. And the Bible talks about don't grow weary in doing good because in due season, God will reward you. And so it's so cool seeing these people that give their last $5 and they think that's all that's going to happen. And the next thing they know, they've got $50,000 to $100,000 coming in. And I like to say it's kind of the opposite of winning the Powerball. It's not these people don't get a blessing on the foundation of greed trying to take, but they actually get a blessing on the foundation of generosity, which is, I think, why they're able to steward it so much better.
So you said you had a vision of this happening. How? How did that come across?
Yeah, just started following Jesus, and I deleted my old videos. I used to do crazy pranks and wild stuff when I was younger, party videos, and I just felt the Lord being like, yeah, I want you to use your gifts for me, but I want you to go, and I want you to highlight the kindness that's in the country. There's so many things we hear in articles and this and that, but the truth is, if you just drive across the country in your car, go into gas stations, talk to people in stores, you'll find that so many Americans really have incredible
hearts.
But
some people blow you off, right?
Some people do, but honestly, a lot of them don't. And even if they do, I can understand, hey, it's a random guy coming up to you, you know? So we never highlight the people that say no. It's all about highlighting the one that says yes.
So here's an example of Sebastian, the blind broom salesman.
Yeah.
So let's listen.
How much for the brooms?
I got one for six or two for $10.
They're pretty good brooms.
You know, I start sleeping, the floor looks dark. I'm done sleeping, still dark.
Right. Do you think you'd be able to do one for five?
One for five?
Yeah, all I got is five on me right now.
Yeah, man.
Really? Thank you. How did you get started doing this?
I couldn't get a job, so I decided to create my own. No one would hire me. When I went to interviews, people first saw my cane, so they just gave it to someone who could see it.
So what's the hardest thing you've been through recently?
Discrimination, to cancer.
Really, you have cancer?
Not me, my wife. But we're scared because she's 30, and her mom lost her life to cancer at the age of 46.
I would love to pray for her.
You know, prayer is better than money any day.
Oh my gosh. Well, guess what? I got $1,000 here for you.
Can I give you a hug?
Yes, yes.
So describe that situation.
Yeah, so Sebastian is a man who's on the corner in Mesa, Arizona, selling mops and brooms, and he's blind. And so
outdoors on the corner.
Yeah, so he just trusts that people give him the amount they're saying they've given him. But I had heard stories of people stealing stuff from him, all this. And I was like, man, I want to go ask this guy for help. So sure enough, he gives me a discount on a broom. I give him $1,000, and a couple days later, I fly back into Arizona because I live in California to go surprise him, and I post on Instagram. I say, hey, come here if you want to be at the surprise, and sure enough, news station showed up. We were able to surprise him with over $100,000. We had a line that was about 100 yards long of everyone buying out everything, and his dream was to be a car salesman, but no one would give him the shot because he was blind, and obviously it just didn't make a lot of sense. Well, a guy was there who owned a car dealership, and he goes, guess what? I'll hire you, Sebastian. The crowd goes crazy. He works there. He sold like five cars in his first month, and so it's a chapter in the book, the first blind car salesman in the state of Arizona.
Wow. So how many do you think you've done so far?
Oh, man, we've probably done hundreds of people. Yeah, I've been doing this for over 5 years. And it's been so encouraging, honestly, just the people, all types of situations, any stereotypes getting broken, like you really just anyone and everyone at any time, rich, poor, they have nice cars, they don't have anything. People are generous, and it's the most powerful thing in the world is thinking about others and not yourself.
And what's been the reaction from your family?
Man, they encouraged me to do this. When my dad told me 5 years ago when I was sitting on his deck, I was working at his restaurant, Jimmy's in Walker, Minnesota, and I'm out on the deck. He goes, what do you want to do with your life? I go, well, I guess it must not be working for you. And so I said, well, if I could do anything, I mean, I know it's not a real job, but I'd like to be like Santa Claus year round, just go around, bless people, encourage them with the love of Jesus, you know, buy them homes, give them cars, but that doesn't exist. And he just looks at me dead serious, and he goes, start tomorrow. And I was like, well, what do you mean start tomorrow? He goes, yeah, if you're serious about it, start tomorrow. So I got my Honda, drove across country, and just did with what I could. You know, the $50 I had, the $100 I had, take someone parasailing, buy someone a meal, started recording these videos, and they grew and grew. And sure enough, now we've raised millions of dollars.
How big is your team?
It's just me and wife helps out here and there.
And who does the shooting? Who does the
I video it with like a hidden camera I wear. And I edit it, everything.
Wow. And you were doing it originally just doing parties, and you knew you had a pretty good at that?
Yeah, I was doing wild stuff back in the day before I met the Lord. I was just, you know, kid who went to church but never really knew following God didn't look like church attendance. It looked like relationship with Jesus. And when God got a hold of my heart when I was 18 years old, it changed everything. And I laid down my gift of videos, everything, and was a missionary living in India, Brazil, Australia. And that's when the Lord said, hey, I want you to go back into this, but I want you to do it for me.
So undercover kindness, saying yes to love, no to fear, and embracing the life-changing power of ordinary generosity is Jimmy Dort's book. The guy who he wrote, the guy who asks people for help, then changes their lives. And the thing is, have you kept yourself anonymous enough? I know, like, for example, the Impractical Jokers.
Yeah.
They don't really, they're hysterical, but now everybody knows them. So yep. It's hard for them to sneak up on people. How do you handle it?
Yeah, I honestly, so I use a hidden camera. So if you watch my videos, 99% of them, you never see my face. Yeah, it's not my face. It's a first person view of the person. And then I just go up to people that aren't really young people that are, you know, technologically savvy and on TikTok and stuff. So I go to people that seem, you know, a little bit older, or I've picked up pretty good how to read people if they know who I am or not. And yeah, for the most part, I very rarely run into somebody that understands what's going on.
So give me an example, if you can, of like how you line up a potential situation. Sometimes you have to walk around for a while to get a subject.
Yeah. Sometimes I drive around in my car. Like I did a video where I was going to ask the first person to give me a hug, give them $500. And I drove around for 8 hours and never felt peace to go up to somebody. I just felt like the Lord was not that person. I'm driving home, the sun's setting. I'm like, God, you're crazy. Like, why you tell me to shoot this video, but no one you gave me peace about. And as I'm driving home, I see this guy and he's on a bike. And I feel like the Lord goes, that's the person. So I pull over, ask this guy for a hug. He stops his bike with his feet because he didn't even have brakes, gives me a hug. I go, man, thank you so much. I want to see the first person kind enough to take time to give me a hug and just encourage me. Here's $500. This grown man just starts weeping. And he ends up sharing that day at work, the boss paid everybody except for him. And he had gotten taken advantage of. And so, yeah, we raised over $40,000 for this guy.
And so a guy in a car pulls over a guy in a bike.
Yeah.
Who's got no brakes on his bike. And just for a hug, you do it. And then that's $500. Yep. Which all these great stories are in Undercover Kindness with Jimmy Darst. Jimmy, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. We got a few minutes, and remember, I'll have a few minutes after, but we're going to do a simulcast on FBN. We'll talk about what's happening in the world and talk about what's happening in business. We're going to be previewing what the Trump administration is on pace to shatter the deportation record, which is pretty amazing. We also know the self-deportation's over 1 million. And we also know that we're actually making that wall that we're building, especially in Texas, a smart wall. So they're going to be able to have sensors all over it as they extend it, really from coast to coast. The president doesn't talk about it because it comes too political when he does, but it's really pretty amazing. So we're about to check in with Stuart Varney now.
Yes, you are checking in with Stuart Varney. He's here right now. He's looking at you, son. All right. Have you seen the New York Post this morning pleading with Republican Curtis Sliwa to drop out of the mayoral race? He's just said this morning he's not dropping out. So, Brian, if he doesn't drop out, do you have any doubt that Mamdani wins the mayoral election in New York City?
Well, I'll tell you, the election experts say no, he's going to win because he's up not by 4. He's up by 18, 13, you know, depending on the polls. And yeah. Cuomo already lost to him in the primary. But if there's 5 million people in New York City, 5.6, and 430,000 show up for a Democratic primary, there's a few votes to be tapped, wouldn't you say, if you could simply do the math, which everyone who watches your channel is probably really good at math. But Cuomo really hasn't done much. I mean, I give him credit for doing our channel because he's trying to win over Curtis Sliwa's supporters in many respects because they see more eye to eye with his policies. And I do think that Curtis has gotten the backing of the New York City Republicans because He's a legitimate Republican. He's a conservative. He's strong on crime. He said, I'm going to get experts in to handle the budgets and things of that nature. But Stewart, if he stays in, they'll definitely lose. I think that Cuomo's going to lose anyway. But the only chance that Cuomo has if his Curtis gets out or teams up. Why not just promise it? Why would Cuomo not pick up the phone and say, listen, if I get into this thing and if I win, I'm going to put you in charge of some type of law enforcement position. At least try to combine rather than people get so mad that Curtis was pushed out, they stay home. Because believe me, he's got loyal followers and they're not going to jump to Cuomo, who is the inverse of Curtis Sliwa.
Yeah, you're right. What a mess it is. Looks like the socialist walks in. There you go. I'm going to change the subject because I've got some interesting stuff here. More than 515,000 illegal migrants have been deported since Trump's inauguration. 1.6 million have voluntarily self-deported. 485,000 have been arrested. Brian, that's exactly what Trump promised on the campaign trail. That's what he promised to do. I just didn't realize that those numbers were so big already. How about you?
70% of which have criminal records, even though, for example, people look at optics and say we're throwing out short-order cooks who have been here for 30 years. That's just not the case. What I would like to do is I expected all those numbers. I did not expect them to seal the border. That thing's people are going to write about for generations. But I would like to do expedite it for people doing it the right way. There's so many people doing it the right way, and it's so costly, time-consuming. There's so much bureaucracy. So if you line up, if you're on a green card, you look to convert this to citizenship, you're playing the perfect game for 10 years, Stewart, you live this life. Why don't we make it quicker for them? Because we need to be one of the few Western societies, very few countries that are adding to their population. While Japan withers and Russia withers and Europe withers, people want to come here. We want the people that are going to fit the criteria. They're going to go through the system. Why not reward them simultaneously?
Do you think we should have some kind of carve-out for industries, like farming, for example? You can employ illegals so long as they're not dangerous criminals, and you can stay. How about that?
I would have expanding the work visa categories. Say you can never be citizens. But if you have a sponsor, which say is your boss, and you've been here for 22 years because of bad policies that have nothing to do with Trump, and people thought this was their opportunity to get in, not the last four. If you've been here a while and you got a sponsor, but when you do that, if these people are being abused and not getting any insurance and not getting any health care, you got to give it to them from the stay, and they can never be citizens. So I think that you could do that. Expanding the work visa is also something very American. You want to come here and work, and then just like you want to come here and study, you should be able to do that easy, where we can track you, where you can, for responsible people that want to be part of the American story. Often you see them from Eastern Europe and from Cuba. You see them from, in some cases, Venezuela, not the TDAs, where they say, man, I just saw socialism. I just saw communism. I saw brutal dictatorship. I would like to apply the right way to come here. And these are the skills that I have. So this way you can lose the mantle or the mislabeling of saying anti-immigrant. No, anti-illegal immigrant. And I will show you with more than just words.
I think some change is coming in that direction. Brian Kilmeade, all right, good stuff. Thanks very much indeed, Brian. See you again soon. Ahead, Victoria.
And Stewart Varney would know, because that's a similar story that he's had when it comes to immigration. He did it the right way, lived in New Zealand, lived in Australia, lived in England, comes here, does it the right way. I think 3 years ago, became an American citizen. I think it should be easier for the people like Stewart to prove themselves in other countries and cultures, and then they prove they want to be an American. I don't know why it's got to be so costly. With money, especially if you're not from a lot of means, you're a middle-class family, you want to come here and work, you want to discover the American dream, you've been checked out, background checked, you've taken the test, you come here, I would make it quicker. And even if it means adding personnel to the immigration system or rewarding people that are able to review and background check in big ways. So with the president, with Stewart had just brought up is what's happening here in New York. Covering the New York Post editorial section, lead editorial Curtis Sliwa, you should drop out. Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove, you might know him, but in the Jewish community in New York, everybody knows him. He is calling on Cuomo to win. Cut eight.
I believe Zohran Mamdani poses a danger to the security of the New York Jewish community. Mamdani's refusal to condemn insightful slogans like globalize the intifada, his denial of Israel's legitimacy as a Jewish state, his call to arrest Israel's prime minister should he enter New York, and his thrice repeated accusation of genocide in Thursday's debate, for these and so many other statements, past, present, and unrepentant, he is a danger to the Jewish body politic of New York City.
And they want him out. Hey, I hope to see you in Pottstown, Pennsylvania on the 1st, a week from this Saturday. Go to BrianKilmeade.com, streamed on Fox Nation.
It's Will Tang Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. Don't forget, coming up on November 1st, Saturday night, it's going to be streamed on Fox Nation, History, Liberty, and Laughs on stage in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. You could watch, but could also attend, BrianKilmeade.com. This hour, we're going to be joined by Bill Hemmer, America's favorite anchor, and John Tesh, one of the Hall of Fame broadcasters, also a singer-songwriter, is an award-winning composer, broadcaster, musician, journalist. Tesh has a new album called Sports, released in September 2025. Features 11 brand-new instrumental tracks and two versions of his iconic Round Ball Rock, which is the NBA theme. That'll be great. Patriot Awards coming up November 6th. Tillis Center, LIU, FoxNation.com/Patriot Awards. When I say star-studded, you can't get bigger. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
What you said in this book is you're angry at the people who tried to push him out.
Yes, that's correct.
Some Americans are going to say, seriously?
But not just the party that pushed him out, the party as it's behaving today.
You said you're a member of the inner circle and you never saw the decline. And after that, I wrote, how?
Clueless KJP still thinks she can snow America while Dems get some early rankings on who they like for 2028.
Number two.
I read a poll this morning that said, a lot of Americans are starting to blame Democrats for the government shutdown. And it's just simply because Republicans are better at messaging than Democrats will ever be. I can't believe Democrats still haven't figured out how to message.
Day 21 of the government shutdown with no end in sight. What will it take to end the Schumer-induced deadlock? We're going to bring you the latest from D.C.
Number one.
We're the only two candidates that agree that billionaires shouldn't determine the future of this city are the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee. That is one place where Curtis and I agree. My advice to him is continue to make his own case.
That is Zohran Mamdani begging Curtis Sliwa to stay in the race because one-on-one, it's a lot closer with Cuomo and Mamdani head-to-head. We examine that as panic spreads in Virginia and New Jersey in the governor's races that the Dems could go down. And not many people saw that as a possibility, but it's indeed true. Think about it. They have a Trafalgar poll last week that showed Winsome Sears within 3 points of Abigail Spanberger. Keep in mind, Glenn Youngkin, who is the governor, and she's a lieutenant governor, very popular. The attorney general spot most likely going to go to Republican after Jay Jones's texts have emerged from what he wrote down in 2022 about killing a Republican and their family. Not that he thought he was sincere, but the fact that you talk about putting bullets in their heads, you find it almost disqualifying. So Spanberger's, they're closing in. So in terms of that, Wes Moore has been showing up. Governor Whitmer's showing up to help her out. Now in New Jersey, Jack Cittarelli is on a mission. He's been working around the clock. Polls show this race is much closer. I mean, I think it was August where it was a 12-point race. Then it was an 8-point race. Now it's a 4-point race, and if you talk to Cittarelli's people, they believe that with the Democrat mayors that are endorsing him and with the early voting that's coming in stronger than the Democrats proportionally, he thinks he's on track to a major upset. Cut 14.
Not to be disagreeable, but our polls have it much closer, and I think it's the reason why you've seen my opponent get so desperate with her attacks, her blatant lies, one of which is going to land her in court. You know, Shannon, I only have 2021 to compare this to. You remember how close that was? I really thought we were going to win this race. This one is very different. The energy across the state is electric. The reception in minority communities has been great. And I'm being endorsed by prominent Democrats. That tells you all you need to know in terms of the people in New Jersey wanting change. And that's what this election is all about, change.
Democrats, Democrats so far, again, panicky here, too. And it looks like Barack Obama, whatever star power he has left, and I don't think it's a lot, whatever star power he has left, he's going to bring it to New Jersey. So maybe he'll get a good crowd. I'll tell you what, with President Obama, keep an eye on that library. It looks horrendous. And he says, I want it to be not to be a mausoleum. I want it to be active. So he has a basketball court in there. He is way over budget. I'm not sure if he's got the money to finish it, but he destroyed the area in Chicago, reportedly, in building it when he was supposed to be building up that area. So Barack Obama is going to take what left of his star power that way. But as I mentioned in the open, KJP has got a book coming out, The Worst Press Secretary in My Lifetime. But I always thought part of the reason, now that the revelations were out about Joe Biden not meeting with staff or having an agenda, part of the reason she was such a waste of time as a press secretary is that he was zoning out. But instead, she has eliminated all excuses for her being less than forthcoming about any policy and find out to be not telling the truth about his vim and vigor behind the scenes. Here she is defending herself in a brand new book on why she left the Democratic Party. Believe it or not, it's because of the way they treated the Bidens. And Joe Biden, prime of his life. Cut 23.
He talked way less to the press than Donald Trump does. Way less. And he wasn't out there at all. He wasn't good off the cuff. He wasn't doing press conferences. Let's just be real. Like, he didn't do night events.
Tim, that's not true. Tim, you're conflating all of it. That's what you're doing. No, you're telling me he didn't talk well about it. Then you're telling me he didn't talk at all.
He didn't do either. He didn't talk very often. And when he did, it wasn't very good. Yeah, he sounded very old.
Maybe you weren't paying attention to what we were doing at the White House.
Really? What were you doing? Not meeting with the Secretary of Defense, not meeting with the Transportation Secretary, having four cabinet meetings in 4 years, having four-hour work days. And you see the stories about them trying to keep big decisions away from him. Nothing before 10 o'clock, nothing after 4 o'clock. Did you see those stories? They're all true. They're told by Democrats. Jake Tapper, it's unbelievable that Jake Tapper had no idea that Joe Biden was failing. And he wrote in Original Sin, the big story was Joe Biden running for re-election. The bigger story was Joe Biden using DEI to pick his press secretary and his vice president, didn't leave Democrats an alternative should he not be able to do the job. If he had Governor Shapiro or even Mayor Pete or somebody extremely competent that picked up the slack for an aging president who's clearly diminished, but instead they had a vice president who was paranoid about everyone turning on her, was unable to have to generate a work ethic. They got anything substantially done or made people feel better about her. She was always talking about how no one defended her. Her speech was circuitous. Her interviews were ridiculous. And because he wanted to pick a woman of color, she was stuck with Kamala Harris. And now KJP wouldn't quit as press secretary, wouldn't take a job in the private sector. So she stuck it out. So he ended up a terrible president with a terrible spokesperson who is now trying to defend the terrible president by continuing, I think, is a flat out lie. And she has a total misperception of how many people actually care about her career and her switch of parties. Here's a little of her on CBS not being able to passed the smell test on their morning show. Cut 24.
When we talk about the mental acuity, and again, I take this very, very seriously. Yeah. I never saw anyone who wasn't there. I saw someone who was always engaged. I saw someone who understood policy, pushed us on the policy, and also understood history. And there were times, I'll tell you the story, there were times where he would call me into the Oval Office, and I would be like, oh, no, because I knew whatever he was going to ask me was going to be direct, was going to be about a story he read, about how we're pushing back, how we're pushing a message forward.
So there you go. It's a total untruth. And no one where is she going with this? If you go on CBS's morning show and Gail does not believe what you're saying because we know the facts and people keep pointing to the debate. Have you been watching the other things? He doesn't know how to leave a stage, get on a stage. He doesn't know how to talk. He's so angry all the time. Somebody else was running the country, and it wasn't even the people that he appointed. It was people that he picked. It wasn't people that had been Senate confirmed. Here's more. Cut 27.
What you said in this book is you're angry at the people who tried to push him out.
Yes, that's correct.
Some Americans are going to say, seriously?
And but not just the party that pushed him out, the party as it's behaving today in this moment when we need a Democratic Party to be fighting.
You said you're a member of the inner circle and you never saw the decline. And after that, I wrote, how?
I take this question incredibly seriously. I do. He aged and he poked fun at it. We always owned up. And with age comes what happens when you get older.
Oh, my goodness. I don't get it. We're going to take a time out. I mean, I this is just the beginning of her book tour. I thought the other one, The Original Sin, was tough to sell. But and then people bought the book because the stuff in there was interesting and it was accurate. But what I didn't buy is Alex Thompson, but Jake Tapper didn't know. Alex Thompson said he's been reporting on it. John Tesh is next. Great guy. There's nothing he hasn't accomplished in his career, and he continues to put out now great music. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So why would we play this bumping music and not fear we're going to get sued? Because the award-winning composer, broadcaster, musician, and journalist is in studio, and he gave me the now wink and a nod that I could do it. John Tesh is here. John, you wrote that with the NBA in mind? Did you write that?
Yeah, I mean, it was 19.
It was a commission.
No, it wasn't a commission. It was 1990. I'm doing the Tour de France with David as an announcer,
right,
and also as a composer. I was writing music for it. And I heard through the sports grapevine that they were looking for a theme because NBC had just gotten the rights away from CBS. And I'm thinking, nobody knew me as a composer. I'm thinking, what would a theme sound like, right? So I woke up in the middle of the night, got this idea. The idea was, can. I called it into my answering machine back in the States. And then the middle section, can. And got back 2 weeks later, checked all my messages. I had two. And I put the thing on my piano and figured out the chords and everything. I got some of my friends, violin players, you know, stuff like that, the orchestra players. And they did a demo, sent it to Terry O'Neill and Tommy Roy, who were at NBC at the time. And they said, well, this will work. Right. And so that's how quickly it happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you were not known as a musician at that.
No. I mean, I knew how to do sport. I was writing sports music, right? Because that's what I was writing for the tour. And so I knew, I guess the advantage for me was that I knew what the template should be. It needed a theme, and then it needed a handoff to the strings, and then it needed a bed so that Marv could go, yes, this today, this, that. And then at the end of it, you know, you needed another bed so they could go, you know, brought to you by whatever.
And now NBC's got it back. And
I know. It's a 35-year-old song.
Right. And they're using it.
Yeah.
So you have Round Ball Rock. That's what you call it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now, but your new album is called Sports.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk to you about it because you're a sports guy. And
yeah.
You write books about sports, too.
Yeah. I'm actually doing a sequel to The Games Do Count, which you were in.
Yeah. I get a lot of people mentioning that.
Lacrosse.
Right. Well, I was a lacrosse and soccer walk on it at NC State because the teams weren't very good.
What year did you graduate college?
I didn't graduate. I left in 1973. I was asked to leave because my dad sent me to school, enrolled. My dad was the vice president of the underwear division of Hanes, and so he wanted me to carry on the underwear legacy. And so he enrolled me at NC State in textile chemistry. I lasted for like 3 years. Then I took a radio and television course to try and raise my GPA, which was 1.9. And I got bit by the bug. And so I went to all my professors and tried to get them
You have this great voice. People must have been saying that to you your whole life.
They all let me drop the course except for my statistics professor, who said, we're past the drop ad date. You can't drop statistics. You have to stick it out. And so I did what one of my fraternity brothers said to do, was I signed my professor's name to the drop ad card. And long story short, my dad got a letter from the chancellor of NC State saying I had broken the honor code. I was being suspended indefinitely. And then my dad kicked me out of the house. And so I lived in a tent in Raleigh for like 6 months working in construction. I got a job sweeping the floors at WKIX Radio where Rick Dees was. One of the news guys showed up hammered, and they had nobody else to put on the air, and that's how the whole thing started for me.
Wow. And then how soon after – by the way, I had no idea. I mean, were you a good kid except for that moment? And is your dad that – was your dad unhappy with other things, or was it
– Yeah. Have you ever seen The Great Santini?
Yes.
You know, yeah. So it's the fighter pilot who runs his family. Sure. My dad. He was World War II. He was a chief petty officer, right? So he ran the family. There was a line in the sand. You didn't cross the line. So I wasn't surprised. People were always like, you know, wow, your dad was really tough. Not really. I knew that if I, you know, did something like that, I'd be thrown out of the house. And so it was the best thing that ever happened to me, though.
Are you the same way as a parent?
No, I'm a total pushover. I mean, I'm a grandpa now of three kids who, between the ages of 14 and 9. And Connie takes care of my wife, Connie Seliger. She takes care of the hard stuff.
Right. Yeah. Really.
What about you?
I'm not the great Santini. I kind of think I'm demanding. They have to answer for them.
Do your kids? Yeah. Do your kids watch you on TV?
I think they do now. Now that one of them's here,
right,
now
right.
that she's – oh, and now I'm getting a million questions.
Yeah, well, they probably like it when Greg Gutfeld tries to make fun of you. Notice I said tries.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we have a good time at night. See, most of the time we tape that at like 6.
Yeah.
It's on at 10. If I'm up at 10, I got to be up at 2:30.
Right.
If I'm watching Gutfeld, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
So gotcha. I usually don't see it, so I don't like live it. Plus, he takes shots at me when I'm not there. So you have
because
to report
half,
to me.
Because he's half your height. That's
right,
why.
Yeah, that's true. But you have to tell me because you're on the West Coast, so right. you could really be a benefit to me.
Yeah.
So what's happening now in California? Katie Porter's a shoo-in.
It's pretty messy. Yeah. It's pretty messy. Yeah. I mean, I have two high-powered fire hoses and a fire hose that pumps out of the pool. You know, the fires almost took us down. It's pretty messy there. Yeah.
It's not rebuilding. It's very slow, right?
It's very, very slow. You know, we're not happy with the – well, not to get too political, but we'd like to move to – We'd like to move somewhere, but Connie's and I, our mission is to stay as close to the grandkids as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the whole thing. You want to be part of their life.
Yeah. I mean, it's because pretty soon they're not going to know who we are. I mean, it's going to be like, yeah, whatever, pop up, you know. And I've only been thrown out of two soccer games, which is amazing.
I can't imagine that.
My gosh. It was unbelievable. The first one was my 13-year-old. Somebody just ran over her, right? I mean, one of the other teammates, right? And I and there's only like 30 people at these games. I got a loud voice, and so I said, "That was a charge!" And there was a building, and they just sort of bounced off all the buildings. "That was a charge! That was a charge!" So the ref stops the game, walks over to me, and says, "You know, obviously you don't know anything about the game. That was not a charge." And so I did what I should have just nodded and just. But what I said was. I said, I do actually know the rules of the game. Actually, I played D1 soccer. And he smiles and goes, "Well, Pop, the rules are a lot different than they were in your day." And that was it. I never should have said that. And it was just like everybody looked. My wife just peeled off. She just left me there. And I'm there with this guy, and he's just ripping me apart.
Ugh. And did he recognize who you were?
No. I haven't been on television in years. Yeah, I mean, I go to Starbucks now, and people go, "Did you used to be John Tesh?" I'm not Brian Kilmeade.
No, you're still. I always tell you that, you know, they always say success leaves clues. They go, when I was coming up, my news director came up to me and said, "Picture two people that you like on television. What do you like about them?" And he asked me a million questions. He goes, "On Prompter, who's the best?" And I go, "The best ever is John Tesh on Entertainment Tonight." And he goes, "Great choice. Watch him every day. Make sure you don't miss his show. Tape it if you don't miss it." So I try to internalize the way you made the teleprompter conversational, the same way you do play-by-play. Was that a gift or is that something you worked on?
It's definitely something I worked on. I mean, I spent hours. I had tapes sent to me of Chuck Scarborough,
who was anchoring
here in town, right? And so that's really how I learned. And it's just repetition, yeah.
So John, do you have Meet Bill Hemmer in person?
No.
Would you like to?
I'd love to.
All right, so don't forget to pick up his album. Download it now. It's titled Sports. John Tesh is brand new. He's an award-winning composer. He's really good at the piano. Don't move.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. For a segment, I want to see if I can put two legends together. Two of America's finest anchors, John Tesh, also in sports as well as news, and Bill Hemmer was started in sports and now is news. And John Tesh has never unplugged. He knows exactly what's going on. Your reaction, this is the first time you two have met.
First time I've ever met John.
Yeah, but I feel like I know you because you're the big board guy. You're the guy where my wife and I go. Because you know my wife, Connie Selica. So we're both entertainers, and we look at you doing that thing, and we're like, she goes, she says to me, she says, you could never do this. And I said, can we talk about something else?
No, that's true.
Yeah, you
could do it.
An audition.
Yeah, thanks. I probably don't remember this, but years ago when I first came on the show on Fox and Friends, we were on the show, and we were having a good time, and the producer comes to me afterwards and says, hey, would you substitute for one of the guys when they're on vacation? You know, you were a newscaster. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, because I really have no idea. I'm going to go on the show and something really bad is going to happen in Yemen. And I have no idea where it is. And she looked at me like, you poor soul. So,
but now you feel differently. Now you're pretty tapped in, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm so tapped in.
But don't you said you watch all the time.
It's a real honor meeting you.
You too.
Yeah, I mean, I've just followed you forever, and it's good to see you here.
Thank you. Right
on.
Thank you.
On top of this, Bill, he's got the Olympic background. Can we play the music again, Pete or Eric? You know who wrote this, the NBA theme, right?
Uh-huh.
So it is called Round Ball Rock. And that's before he was known as a musician.
Is that right? So you did that you did that on computers, synthesizer?
No, they're not my answering machine. I was telling Brian, 1990, I was working on the Tour de France, and I heard that NBC was looking for a theme. And I said, what would this sound like? And so I called it into my answering machine. And then when it ended up on Saturday Night Live, do you remember this thing where they made Jason Sudeikis did like a whole spoof of the song? That's when it started coming back. So
and by the way, so NBC gets it back and they bring back the song, and now he's got a brand new album out called Sports.
Yeah, it's the stuff that you'll work out to, basically.
Really?
Yeah.
No lyrics.
Do we have can I listen to it?
No. It's going to cost you. You cannot listen to it.
We don't have a sample. You brought it. Come on. You brought a sample from that.
You download? I mean, the Amazon thing is over.
I'll check it out.
You must have been saying.
Where do you exercise? What did I do? Okay. What is your exercise routine?
I do hot yoga.
Oh, gosh, really?
Can't have music to that.
They will never allow that.
Right.
Especially in this.
It's also hard booking a band in hot yoga because everything gets so sweaty.
Yeah. So stuff like this.
You might be onto something.
I'm getting messages.
by the way, it's a little Rocky-esque,
really good.
Right?
Right. Yeah. Well,
if there was a Rocky 8, that would be the theme song.
Did we stop at 7 or was it 5?
I'm pretty sure. No, did we stop?
Are
I think,
we
yeah.
Counting?
No, I think we went to Creed.
Creed 1, 2, 3. I just finished watching those again. Yeah, that's so you got it. Rocky 4 soundtrack is my baseline for writing.
So let me ask you, Bill Hemmer, you got the sports background, the news background. Yes. John, you have entertainment, you have sports, and you have news. Do you find yourself staying up with entertainment? I feel like during your era with Access Hollywood, Entertainment Tonight, it was much more interest in the entertainment world. Now I feel like the reality world has taken over the celebrity world.
Yeah, it's a good question. Here's what happened. I was there from 86 to 96, right? And during that period,
Entertainment Tonight.
I would probably say from 86 to 90, I love the data. I love ratings. 23 million people a night were watching Entertainment Tonight.
23 million?
23 million
That's
people
That's what the AFC Championship game
was. It was like a 65 share or something like that. It was in Access, you know. And then but then slowly but surely, with social and everything, entertainment news became a commodity, you know. And
what year did you start to recognize that decline?
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. I would say probably 95, 96.
Wow.
You know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Because that's when cable is just really starting to crank up.
Right,
because
exactly.
CNN was in its heyday.
Right, yeah.
Fox was coming on board a year later with MSNBC.
I think YouTube was like in the early 2000s.
That's changed everything, too.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know what I think, John? I think in the digital age, I don't think anything that we have known will ever stay constant.
Yeah, yeah.
Like our business, we're well aware how quickly it's changing and other people get access to news and information. And I think as long as we're alive, that aspect of our life will always be in transition. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I also have to say, because I've got the both of you here and on my new show that I'm hosting right now with you,
you are the center. You're part of the center square.
I believe that the broadcasters who start or at least have had some training in sports, like both of you, can do anything. Right, because you have to always be that far ahead. Do you agree?
I think it is especially beneficial in the cable news world.
Yeah.
Because like as sportscasters, your brain is trained to look at an image and tell your mouth what words to say.
Right, exactly.
And so it's a rolling play-by-play of what you're watching on a monitor.
Yeah, yeah.
And we do that for hours every day at a time. It's a great advantage.
But don't you think also, John, the thing about Fox is they want your personalities to come out.
Right.
Well, it's hard to get the personality out if you're on prompter to prompter. If it's a news story to Saad, news story to reporter.
Fair.
What happens is the interaction with people, that's who you're encouraged to be yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You're not encouraged to be stiff and stay away from this. It's whatever happens with you and Dana in between. Yep. Whatever happens with you and Brett on election night. There's no manager or producer telling you what to say.
That's true. Go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say that I guarantee you I watch more Fox News than you guys do. We watch all the time. We got it in the car, and I'm not just saying that. But what's fascinating, I'm not going to name any names. It's fascinating when there's somebody who's in an ad-lib, so when they come on as an expert, right? And then all of a sudden they get their own show. You can see, and maybe it's just me because I've been doing that for so many years. You can see when they're learning how to use the prompter,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Because it's tough. Yeah. I mean, I think it's tougher to ad-lib, obviously. But the prompter stuff is...
What helped me a lot was Sports Phone. To get you ready, if you could do sports, like sports or news talk, because there's no script, you have ideas of what you want to say. But Sports Phone, I do 40 hours a week before All Sports Radio, 976-1313. You do updates, every 7 minutes, 40 hours a week. But you do it with box scores and bullet points, and you try to look, that news story's got 7 seconds, I got 50 seconds left. I always felt, number one, I'm still trying to slow down because you try to get as much information as possible. But I always thought the fact that one of my first job was without a script was a huge help.
Yeah.
And then when I went on a script, that was a huge adjustment. I'm like, I know what to say. Like, no, we want you to say that. That was adjustment for me.
How do you develop a skill? Go ahead.
No. What's the question?
How do you develop a skill like what you do with the board when you do election night?
Fair
question.
Because
you don't have one at home, right?
No.
I mean,
I don't want one. I think practice and preparation is the best tool to utilize it the best on come election night. Yeah. I think the other thing is that you have to really know. You have to understand where the trap doors are in the software for the program.
Interesting.
And the reason for that is when you're flying through that sucker on election night, you got real data in real time. And if you make a mistake or if the board makes a mistake, you have to know how and where to bail out in an instant.
Right.
And you can save an entire segment that way.
Right.
And I think the only way to see it is just run. Like when I leave with you guys today at 12:30, I'm going down the studio to start running through things for 14 days from now.
Right.
So we'll run through New Jersey, run through Virginia. I find that, you know, you grew up in Jersey.
No, Long Island.
He can't stop with the Jersey stuff.
I'm sorry. I thought the first thing you said was Jersey City. So, yeah, that's stuck in my brain. What I want to tell you guys is that we've never had to study New York City before. It's never been a contest.
Yes, yeah.
Seven Democrats, every one Republican,
if it's
not even higher than that. Studying the five boroughs of New York has been an absolute thrilling and fascinating ride for me because I've lived here for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
But I didn't know where Sunnyside was in Queens.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Right. And if you look at the detailed maps for a borough like Brooklyn, 2.7 million people. Now you think about on election night, if this sucker's close, it might be, it might not be. If this is close and you're watching from my home state of Ohio, for example,
right.
And you hear that one borough has nearly 3 million people.
Right.
Think about the intensity of the humanity that lives there. So you can literally walk from neighborhood to neighborhood, and you can find yourself transposed between different religions, different language, every ethnicity on the planet.
Yeah.
Queens has 160 languages. The deeper we go, the more I learn and the more fascinated I am by it because there's so much nuance to what happens with 8.5 to 9 million people who live in such a small area.
But how about this? How about the fact that he won the primary with 400,000 votes?
Yeah.
So people say, well, that's what happens. He's got to win by 20. Who's going to catch up to him? Well, what if all these people decide this is the one election I want to vote in? Because it's usually the die has been cast.
Can I tell you?
Sliwa against Adams is not really going to get me to the polls. I know who's going to win.
Yeah.
But this might be different.
In the early 90s, John, when you lived in New York, turnout in 1993, it was 57%. Ever since then, it's on a steady decline every year.
Yeah.
And I think 4 years ago, I think we had about 21% turnout in New York.
Yeah, de Blasio got elected by 11 people.
I think there's going to be massive turnout. Yeah. And polls close at 9 o'clock, kind of late for an East Coast time zone. And I think the Board of Elections has to really be careful here. They have to be ready for a massive influx of people that they haven't seen in 30 years.
Good. I would hate to have a controversial election because that never happens. That's all we need.
How does the No King stuff play into this coming up here?
I don't think it does. I think those people are either Mamdani or Cuomo anyway, and nothing much is going to change their mind. They don't have another option. Yeah. So I would say not much.
Do you think most of the No Kings protesters actually know what they're protesting?
It's a fair question. I did not hear free Palestine in any one of the rallies because for the moment that has been, how would we say, alleviated for the
because
moment.
They have to think, and then we're like, we don't know what's going on, and we have to cheer for Hamas executing
Palestinians. I will say that one thing I think that was highly offensive for all Americans, and I'm not taking away from what they did. I don't know if they had 5 million people or 9 million people. We can debate numbers on another day.
Right.
But I saw so many signs talking about fascism and fascists, and we're just a month and a half removed from this killer of Charlie Kirk in Utah. And I you can do and you can say what you want, but I just found that highly offensive.
Right. But boy, these protests are huge. I mean, it seemed to be to me.
Well, I'll put it this way. You have all these people. There are a lot of people voted for Kamala Harris. They decided to come out and vote. The No Kings doesn't even apply. If there was a king, I don't think the president would be going up the chain to find out if he could put National Guard in Portland or in Chicago. I don't think that what's his name, who just had a press conference before Khalil? Khalil just had a press conference before. Yeah, Mahmoud Khalil just had a press conference. President Trump is still trying to throw him out of the country with his antics at Columbia and violating his visa operations. That's usually not how kings work, according to the history books I've been
involved in. I think Democrats, John, have been trying for months now to push back on Trump on something, and this is the something they have found.
Yeah. Right. Are you against or for the robbery at the Louvre? Do you have any?
I don't have a comment.
Right. Napoleon?
I think the clues are in the truck they left behind outside. Unless it was stolen, I mean, you're going to be able to trace that thing.
Yeah. Right. Of course, they always check your credit rating when you have to rent a crane.
Let's get back into inside baseball here. How do you guys, because you're always on the air, how do you stay up? I mean, is your phone like always on and you're always updating yourself?
It is for me. Brian, I assume the same
you. People like, you're on the phone. I'm only on the phone checking the news and perspectives and find out what's going on. I'm not on the phone like scrolling. But I'm interested. I'm not embarrassed. In the beginning, people are like, what are you doing? I'm like, now I just tell people, this is what I like doing. Even on vacation, I'll take some time. But for the most part, I cannot let a day go by without knowing what's going on. Because at some point on this show or another show, there'll be a gap.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, you heard what happened before. You remember how it started? Yeah, right, and I'll be like, well, those are the 2 days I was on vacation.
100%.
That doesn't work. You can't take a day off.
Do you guys have family rules as to when you can be on and off?
I try to put some rules on myself for like 4 hours at a time on a Saturday because I love to play golf because it allows my mind to unwind and get away from it. Yeah. But like yesterday I was at a charity function at Tunnel to Towers and I was itching to like, well, you know, I have to check my text messages. I got to check the email and make sure that I scroll through X and make sure that Dana doesn't hit me with a question the next day that I haven't heard about.
Right. Just toss to break in case of emergency. John Tesh, do you like Bill Hemmer? So I have to go to break now, but has this been a good meeting?
I mean, it's the beginning of a friendship.
I can see you keep it in touch.
There's a song on the album, on the sports album called Legendary. That's him.
And to get John's album, go to johntesh.sports. Round Ball Rock's included in that, and the name of his album is called Sports, correct?
Yes.
John Tesh.
Yes.
Bill's, thanks so much. Multi-talented.
Both you guys. Both you guys. Yeah.
I was all junior high, eighth grade. No one talks about that. I don't know why.
You're all junior high?
Yes.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, everybody. We're just keeping you up to date on what's happening. Also, great to see John Tesh again, but Bill Hemmer, real life is snooking back in while we were on the air.
Uh-huh.
There was a press conference over in Israel, and we had Jared Kushner there, Steve Witkoff, and J.D. Vance. Yeah. And they said the peace is holding, but it's not going to be easy.
Yeah, they talked a lot about getting the international force in there and working, how important that was. I just think Witkoff is such a fascinating, accomplished guy. Between the interview he did with 60 Minutes on Sunday night, Kushner as well, and just to listen to how optimistic they are to making it work. And Witkoff was saying how much they've learned. It was like, and future contests globally, we'll be able to use the example we're putting together here to help other conflicts. He's seeing that far in advance. I think the other important thing is that J.D. Vance said if they're talking about reconstruction in Hamas, and they would do it around the air, not where Hamas operates, but the area where the IDF now has cornered off. Vance said, if Hamas doesn't cooperate, it will be obliterated. His word.
And that goes over well with everybody, because that's really the feeling that they have in Israel. They don't want any more war, but they thoroughly believe that Hamas is going to be, doesn't exist without violence. And then when you witness the execution over the weekend of 33 people, I think it was maybe even on Friday, of who were involved in maybe helping out Israel or involved in the clans that Israel had identified and armed. So you know there's going to be an issue, but we're not in phase two. Phase two is when they're supposed to disarm.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it holds. They have more optimism than I do. After being there 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, Brian, I don't think people understand the scale of reconstruction that needs to take place. It is block after block and street after street from what we saw in southern Gaza through the town of Rafah for 5 miles, Brian. It was pile after pile of concrete and rebar. Nothing else.
Well, I am convinced they can do it, but I'm convinced they can't do it if people are shooting at them. So you look at a tsunami, you look at an earthquake, you look at a tornado, same thing all at once. Got it. But if you want them to rebuild it, we can rebuild it. The world can rebuild it. We got they certainly have the money. But not if they feel as though if I work like these guys was standing there on an excavation site and these two IDF guys got killed.
Yeah. I don't know what the exact details are for how they got killed. There's a question back and forth. Here's what I will tell you, though. What the IDF did not do during this recent war is they did not go into parts of Gaza City and the neighborhood to the west where Hamas really is truly active. They went everywhere else except there.
They were going there.
If the next war happens and this obliteration warning from J.D. Vance takes place, they'll go to those parts of Gaza next.
Right.
If necessary.
Because the hostages are out. There'll be no handcuffs.
Correct.